A perusal of news headlines can convince you that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, but take all the challenges apart, and each individual challenge can also represent an opportunity, a chance to fix a situation and change the conditions that produced it. Our first guest this hour looks at crises around the world and how they were handled. Jonathan Tepperman is the author of The Fix: How Countries Use Crises to Solve the World's Worst Problems. Jonathan Tepperman is the managing editor of Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has also worked for Newsweek International and has had his work published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, among others. Jonathan Tepperman, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Jeffrey.
So I understand this book was at least partly born of frustration. Over what?
Well, it had to do with an intuition and a frustration. And the intuition was that things in the world were not quite as bad as commonly portrayed. Now, that may sound like a crazy thing to say today. It even sounded crazy 2 or 3 years ago when I started working on the book. But I had this feeling that there were lots of good news stories and positive trends and developments that were getting overlooked. And the overlooked part is where the frustration came in. I felt I've been working in this field, international affairs and journalism, for about 20 years, and I had been feeling increasingly annoyed by my colleagues in the field and the literature on international affairs as well, for the way that it tends to focus on bad news, on big problems, on all the things that are going wrong in the world, and not on the more positive developments, of which there were a lot. But as I said, when I started this process, it was all really just based on a hunch. So I said to myself a few years ago, well, you know, you're the editor of this foreign policy magazine. Why don't you actually see if there's anything to this by going around the world and starting to talk to people and asking them if and how they've tackled their big domestic political and economic problems. And what I found out, much to my delight and somewhat to my astonishment, was that, in fact, there have been remarkable signs of progress on this long list of problems, but we rarely hear about them here in the United States.
Did you find solutions in some fairly unlikely places?
Yeah, I absolutely did. And in fact, when I set about starting to write the book, I tried to focus on the most surprising stories. And when I was winnowing down my list of which narratives I would include and which I would cut, I decided to eliminate some that seemed less surprising. So, for example, there are examples of Sweden or other Scandinavian states doing lots of things right, but the idea that a Scandinavian state does something properly is not going to surprise anybody. But the idea, for example, that Botswana, which is an African country that very few people in the United States have heard anything about, could have overcome what's known as the resource curse, which is this phenomenon where great natural resource wealth tends to destroy a country's politics and actually make it poorer rather than richer, and that Botswana had done it through spectacularly good governance. Now, that was a big surprise. Similarly, I have a chapter on how Indonesia virtually conquered Islamic extremism in the last decade, or how Brazil managed to make great strides in the fight against inequality. And all of those stories are surprising in the case of Indonesia because most people don't realize that it's the largest Muslim country in the world, and B, would be shocked to hear that anywhere is making great progress against extremism. Brazil, because for so many years it had not just had a problem with inequality, but it had virtually defined the problem. So the idea that the worst exemplar of the problem could have turned itself within a short decade into the test case for how you tackle it right. Now that was, you know, wildly counterintuitive and so really appealing to me as a storyteller and as a journalist.
I do want to come back to those examples, Brazil, Indonesia, and Botswana. I guess I'm getting stuck on the word use in the subtitle, how countries use crises to solve the world's worst problems. Are you suggesting countries create crises or just how
No.
they...
No, not at all. But, you know, when I looked at the stories together in the process of writing my conclusion. And figuring out how to conclude a book like this was a bit tricky because I didn't start out with a grand unified field theory for how countries solve problems. Instead, I just went looking for the biggest problems and then the most interesting cases of countries that had figured them out. So I needed a way to stitch it all together when I got to the end of the book. And what I did was read all of the stories again, consider them as a whole, and see whether there were any common themes or strands or tools of problem solving that all of the countries had emerged and that really stood out when you looked at these cases together. And the most dramatic of those common themes that did pop right out at me was this idea of crises. Now, I should hasten to add that, you know, countries face crises all the time. That's nothing special. But what was so interesting about the countries that I ended up studying was that in each one of these cases, their moment of salvation, the big breakthrough, came at a time of extreme and, in some cases, existential peril. That is, the countries in a lot of these stories were really on the brink of, if not destruction, then a terrible, terrible period in their history. But what happened in each one of the cases that I highlight was that they were lucky enough to have leaders who recognized that those crises, as well as being frightening and dangerous, also created an extraordinary opportunity. And the opportunity was to break the ordinary rules of politics and the way things are done, and to write new rules. Because what crises do is they concentrate the minds of both voters and politicians and make it more likely that they will go for deep, radical, and in some cases painful changes that they would try to avoid under ordinary circumstances.
And the solutions are not without some controversy. We'll get to that when we come back and talk more with Jonathan Tepperman about the fix on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is Jonathan Tepperman, the managing editor of Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's written a book that examines how countries have emerged from some very trying times in their history. It's called The Fix, How Countries Can Use Crises to Solve the World's Worst Problems. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And you start off with listing what the challenges are, the terrible 10, starting with inequality, moving on to immigration, Islamic extremism, civil war, corruption, the resource curse, energy, the middle income trap, gridlock 1 and gridlock 2. What do you know? Gridlock shows up on the list twice. But Jonathan, you start with inequality. Why do you say that's an inevitable byproduct of capitalism?
Because that's the way things have worked in virtually every country in the world in the modern era, and it's a problem that is getting worse, not just in the West, but in the developing world as those countries get richer as well. So the last decade or the first decade of this century, between 2000 and 2010, inequality was growing rapidly, not just in the United States and in Western Europe, but also in China, in India, in Brazil. Brazil is the big exception, but it had been growing there as well. Virtually every country that was growing was getting poorer fast, or getting more unequal fast, and this was becoming an enormous concern. And the reason that I stuck it at the front of my book is because I think inequality is behind so much of the popular and public anxiety that is producing or has produced this disenchantment with conventional politics, and has helped fuel the rise of populist politicians here and abroad, because people, especially working class folks without college educations, it's not just that they've seen their own livelihoods become a lot less certain and stable in recent decades, but that's been happening at a time when a small proportion of the population has been getting wildly, wildly rich in a way that none of us have ever seen before. And that is a great contributor to this public rage that, among other things, contributed to the election of Donald Trump last November.
So you say Lula in Brazil, he tends to go by just that name, did find an approach to inequality that seemed to work. What is that?
Right. So Lula was elected president of Brazil in about in 2002, and when he came into office, a lot of people were frightened that he was a far-left, possibly Marxist radical who would take Brazil in an extreme direction that would result in class warfare. And sure enough, in his the 2002 campaign was Lula's fourth attempt to become president. And in prior campaigns, he had talked about things like nationalizing industry and redistributing wealth. That made people very, very nervous, including foreign investors in the United States. So when Lula finally became president and had the opportunity to attack poverty and inequality, which was his great cause, because in large part he had grown up incredibly impoverished himself, dropped out of school after the second grade to shine shoes and then worked in factories. He decided to go about it in an innovative way that would get buy-in not just from the poor but from all of society. And so what he decided to do, which seemed incredibly radical at the time, was not launch yet another huge anti-poverty program focusing on things like job training or skills or providing the poor with assets or food, things like that. He simply started handing out cash. Now, the reason that seemed so crazy at the time was there was this consensus among development experts, the people with PhDs who run organizations like the World Bank, that that if you gave the poor money, they would just blow it on smokes and booze and shiny trinkets. But Lula, who'd grown up poor, knew differently, so he started a program to hand small amounts of cash to the mothers of poor families across Brazil. Now, it wasn't just a handout, and this is part of what made Lula's program so politically savvy. He attached several conditions to the grants. So mothers who received the money would have to ensure that their kids got immunized, that they got regular health checkups, and that they stayed in school until the age of 15. And that did two things. One, it helped ensure that those kids would have the tools to break out of poverty as they aged, the tools that their parents had lacked. But two, it was a very savvy political ploy, because what the conditions did was show the middle class and the wealthy in Brazil that this wasn't just a giveaway to the poor, but it was a new sort of form of social contract that required the poor to do their part as well. And so that made it much more politically appealing, as well as a couple other components of the program.
How much staying power has the program had, though? And Lula is no longer in office and, in fact, is supposed to go to prison for 10 years for corruption. Has that pretty much undone his good?
Right. And that's a really important question, because Lula, as you say, has gotten into big trouble in recent years, as I should say, have a number of the other leaders in my book. And the point of the book is not to suggest that any of the people that I talk about are heroes who should be emulated in every way, or that the breakthroughs that they achieved will survive forever. They require a lot of maintenance to keep going once the breakthroughs have occurred. But the one of the great things about the Brazil story is that although Lula's star has fallen, and although Brazil now is in a terrible state of economic and political crisis, the gains achieved by Lula's great anti-poverty and inequality program have continued. And the program remains as popular today as it was a decade ago. And part of the reason for it is it was so intelligently designed, because it was so radically simple. The money was simply transferred from the government to the poor people who would get it on an electronic bank card and then would go to the bank to withdraw the money. That simplicity has ensured that, unlike virtually every other government program in Brazil today, there's no corruption associated with Bolsa Família, the anti-poverty program, for the simple reason that nobody's been able to figure out how to steal the money.
Jonathan Tepperman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Fix, How Countries Use Crises to Solve the World's Worst Problems. He calls it a good news book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about Lula da Silva and his undoing through corruption charges. He's supposed to go to prison for 10 years, the sentence handed down 2 weeks ago. Let's jump ahead then to the portion of the book where you do talk about corruption. How bad was Singapore, the example here, and how did it turn around?
Right. So Singapore is another one of these surprise stories. Not today, because a lot of people now are aware that Singapore is one of the least corrupt countries on earth. But what I loved about that story was that when Singapore first became independent from the United Kingdom in 1959, it was one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. In fact, it was known as Singalore, not just because it was for all of the whorehouses and casinos and dens of iniquity that had made it famous when it was a naval port during the Second World War, but because you had to pay a bribe to get anything done in the country. In 1959, if you got hit by a car on Singapore streets, you'd have to bribe an ambulance driver before you could get taken to the hospital. So things were just about as bad as could have been imagined. And now fast forward to today, Singapore is one of the least corrupt countries on the planet. So the question is, how did Singapore get there? And the key insight of Lee Kuan Yew, who was Singapore's first leader and then continued to run the country for many years, was that corruption avarice are inevitable features of human society, and you're never going to get rid of them. So rather than hoping that the problems would go away, what Lee Kuan Yew did was accept that the problem will be there forever, that human behavior can't be changed, and so what you need to do is design a system that acknowledges those truths and then acts to solve for them. And so he didn't just increase the penalties for corruption, although he did that as well. In Singapore, not only if you're a government official, not only do you lose your job and face a stiff prison term if you're caught with your hand in your till, but your boss will probably lose his or her job as well. Not only did he invest a lot in public education programs. In Singapore, when you go to the movies, there's often a little government-sponsored trailer before the film starts that in which animated characters talk about the evils of corruption. But the government also worked really hard to remove cash from society and from interactions between government officials and the public, so there would be fewer sort of touch points and far fewer opportunities for individuals who might be inclined to pay a bribe or to receive one to be able to do so. So it radically reduced the number of fees and tariffs. It cut red tape. It cut the number of government officials across the board. It also started paying government officials enormous salaries to try and reduce the motivation for them to try and grift ordinary citizens. You know, one of the reasons corruption is such a problem in poor countries is because police officers and other officials who civilians interact with on a daily basis are often paid so badly that they have no choice but to, or feel like they have no choice, but to try and supplement their incomes on the backs of ordinary folks. In Singapore, a mid-level civil servant makes more than the president of the United States, although not this president with his private income, but I mean the official
with the salary, yeah. So, but do you have to take the harsh with the effective? I mean, Singapore is also famous as a place you can get caned for having chewing gum, or was anyway. And
right.
I just wonder if that's all of a piece.
Yeah, and I had to be really careful because I didn't want to. There are a number of leaders in the book besides Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore who were authoritarians. But I didn't want to seem to be suggesting that you could only make these kinds of strides in authoritarian states. Now, you know, making big reforms in dictatorships is obviously easier than it is in democracies for a lot of reasons, because you don't have to ask permission and you don't have to consult with nearly as many people. But what is interesting about the corruption story in Singapore, or about South Korea's economic miracle, which also started under a dictatorship, is those particular policies didn't depend on the authoritarian nature of the state. So while Singapore has imposed harsh penalties for corruption and has reversed the presumption of innocence when it comes to corruption cases. So if an official is found to have more money in their bank account than can be easily explained, it's incumbent on the official to explain where it came from. It's important to emphasize, for example, that once you get charged with corruption, you still go to court, and Singapore's courts have a reputation for impartiality. They follow the British system, and by all accounts, they're very clean, and so citizens still do get a very fair hearing there. So the corruption agency in Singapore has the power of search and subpoena, but that's not very different from the police powers that exist, and the ability of American cops, for example, to search you or your person or your car if they have probable cause to do so.
Jonathan Tepperman is our guest on The Exchange. He is the managing editor of Foreign Affairs and the author of The Fix, How Countries Use Crises to Solve the World's Worst Problems. Let's get to Indonesia, in that same part of the world, a very large Muslim country and a unique approach to Islamic extremism. Looked like it was on its way to civil war or Balkanization or something else, but it didn't become like either Iraq or Egypt. How?
Right. In 1999 or 1998, after many, many years of rule by this harsh authoritarian dictator named Suharto, the Indonesian people rose up and overthrew him. And it was an incredibly exciting moment of people power. But as you say, it was also a very scary one, because Indonesia is the largest Muslim country on earth and is made up of 17,000 islands where people speak close to 1,000 different languages. So in some ways, it seemed to never make sense as a country in the first place. And people feared that democracy would mean either that the country would fall apart or that the radicals, and there were a lot of them at the time, would take over. And in the first year or so of liberty, that is indeed what seemed to be happening. The country virtually caught fire. Civil wars started to rage around the nation, and Islamic radicals killed thousands and thousands of people. And this was made most dramatic in October 2002 when, as many of us will still remember, this, there was this horrifying bomb attack at a resort bar on the island of Bali that left 200 people dead, and most of them were Americans and Australians. But what that crisis did was really focus the attention of Indonesia's leaders at the time, that it forced them to recognize that they had this big problem with extremism, and unless they acted fast and in sweeping ways, it risked swamping the country. And so they did four or five key things. The first thing they did was work really hard to consolidate the new democracy. And what that did was show ordinary Indonesians that democracy could work, could actually be a good thing. And that was one of the things that helped the government win the war of public opinion against the Islamists. And then they did a few other things in this regard as well. The second was that they appropriated key parts of the Islamic Party's agenda. Those parties, like parties elsewhere in Egypt, in Pakistan, throughout the Middle East, tended to focus on things like cutting corruption and on economic development for the poor. So that's what the secular parties started emphasizing as well, thereby stealing those key issues. They even brought some of the Islamist politicians into government. And what that did, although it horrified a lot of secular Indonesians who wanted to keep them out, was it forced the Islamist politicians to actually start trying to govern. And it got them mixed up with all of the petty compromises and humiliations that are part of ordinary politics. And that took a lot of the shine off their image. You know, it's a lot easier to remain pristine when you're in the opposition, but when all of a sudden you have responsibility for making things work, it has an amazing way of tarnishing your image fast. Now, Indonesia also had a problem with terrorism, and so the government started cracking down on that. And it did so in a really vigorous way. But Indonesia's democratic president had learned a key lesson from the harsh years of dictatorship, and that was that repression only creates more extremism, as we've seen in countries around the world like Egypt and others. And so they were determined to avoid that mistake. So when they fought their war on terror, they did it in a very careful, almost delicate way, and they treated it as a law enforcement problem and not as a military problem. And they only held suspects if they had enough evidence, and they held public trials. And they launched a huge PR campaign to emphasize moderation. And what all of that did was made it much harder for the radicals to claim the status of victims. And all of that together made extremism much less popular among ordinary Indonesians.
And that's in Indonesia, one of many examples given in the book The Fix by Jonathan Tepperman, How Countries Use Crises to Solve the World's Worst Problems. A really interesting read, and they're not without their share of controversy, all these examples. Jonathan Tepperman, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure, Jeffrey.
All right, take it easy.